Hello and welcome to the Multiplanetary Society podcast, where we explore topics related to the space economy and the why and how of potentially becoming a multiplanetary species. I'm your host, Timothy Reuter. Today, we are pleased to have with us Vanessa Clark, CEO of Atomos Space, and William Kowalski, COO of Atomos Space. Vanessa and William, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tim. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
So let's start with the basics. Tell us about what Atomos Space does and the vision behind it.
So Atomos Space is building what we call orbital transfer vehicles, or OTVs, also called space tugs. These are essentially reusable spacecraft that are able to relocate satellites and payloads in space. Our goal is to provide last mile transportation services to our customers who are predominantly satellite operators so that they can do new missions in different orbits or do their existing business more cost effectively.
And so right now, the way it works is you have a rocket, launch your payload, and then the payload usually has some form of propulsion on it to get to its final destination. So how does what you're proposing to do change the dynamics of that?
Yeah, so for space missions today, we have to take everything with us on the rocket from the ground, and it's really used just once. Mm-hmm. So today's model, as you outlined, so satellite operators, payload operators launch their entire payload with a propulsion system onboard the rocket. This is kind of like flying a FedEx van in the FedEx plane with the package. What we're doing is putting the delivery vans at the airport and then reusing them. So we're freeing up capacity, both in terms of volume and mass in rockets, for more payloads. And the reuse of our orbital transfer vehicles means that rather than throwing away everything at the end of a mission, we just have lower costs because of the reuse. And one thing that is really exciting, and it's part of the reason why we started the company, is that having this type of infrastructure in space that's able to move payloads around enables new missions. If you think about the payloads that we can take out of Earth orbit, go interplanetary, so Mars capture, for example, I think is relevant for this podcast. Mm-hmm. Those payload mass fractions are really limited. But if you already have infrastructure in space that's doing the transportation, the payload mass we can take to those destinations increases. And also because we reuse our systems, we can invest a lot in the propulsion system itself. So we can have high performance to not just move heavier payloads, but to also move more quickly.
Right. So this is exactly where I wanted to head with this conversation. And I'd really like to dive into your approach to propulsion. My understanding is you started with an eye towards nuclear propulsion and have since transitioned to ammonia-based propulsion paired with lightweight power systems. How did that transition come about?
So we still have an eye to nuclear, and that's still where we're going. What we are doing is fielding technologies that need to be matured before we have a high-performance nuclear system, but that also can serve really relevant and compelling commercial missions over the next couple of years. So I can talk about my background a little bit, but I was researching high-power electric propulsion systems and other propulsion methodologies to do missions like get astronauts to Mars. Mm-hmm. And there are some technologies that we're just not investing in that aren't really nuclear-specific, so not so much a nuclear mm-hmm. reactor core, but the power management distribution to get power out of that core, and high power, high throughput propulsion systems. These are the technologies that we're fielding before realizing a nuclear system that also can serve really compelling missions.
Yeah, I mean, there's some practical realities of fundraising and getting something into orbits that we learned early on. I think when we started the company, and we're incorporated in Atomos Nuclear and Space Corporation. And after about a year, we ended up filing for a DBA doing business as Atomos Space. Because you'd be amazed how many doors get closed just because you have nuclear in the title. And you have space and nuclear. It's very difficult, particularly at the time So when we started the company in 2018, there wasn't independent line items in NASA or DOD's budget for space nuclear. It was still kind of not talked about as much. That has changed quite a bit in the history of the company. So we looked at what is the minimum viable spacecraft we could get up in orbit and then progress the business towards the eventual goal, which is space nuclear. Then there is a kind of a regulatory component of that where, you know, a lot is put into nuclear safety on the ground, but what makes a nuclear system safe on the ground is not necessarily what would make it safe in space. It comes more in this, how the spacecraft works, how it's, how we control it, making sure we don't lose control and it accidentally re-enters, not really about criticality of the reactor. So to help with the licensing and safety, it's, let's demonstrate we can build spacecraft, operate spacecraft, and then we add the nuclear component later.
Right. And my understanding is you aren't even allowed to run nuclear propulsion systems on Earth. So the only way to even accomplish this is to do something like what you're talking about, where you're putting these systems in space to do the movement. Am I correct about that?
With, let's say, ground testing of space nuclear propulsion systems, it is a little bit difficult just because of the licensing involved. Some of the operating regimes of reactors for this application are really outside of what the Department of Energy and the Nuclear Regulatory Commission have experience with. Right now, NASA is looking to build up a huge test facility to test their nuclear thermal rocket, and they have to make sure that they capture 100% of the exhaust because they can't guarantee that any dangerous products won't make their way into the exhaust. I mean, they shouldn't, but if there is a failure during test, they might. So I would say that it is impossible to do testing on the ground or to run this system on the ground. It's just really cost prohibitive because of the licensing involved and then some of the special facility requirements. Mm-hmm. Although the thing that we'd like to add as a caveat is that we're not running propellant through a hot reactor core. Our approach is a little bit different in terms of harvesting the energy from the reactor and then using a more conventional electric thruster. So we don't have the same test facility issues that NASA has, but again, it would be very difficult and expensive to do this on the ground.
One final question before we break from the nuclear, although we may come back to it.
We could stay here. I love talking about nuclear propulsion.
Okay, then two quick ones. One is, do you see yourselves doing NEP or NTP, nuclear thermal propulsion or nuclear electric propulsion?
So nuclear electric propulsion, and part of the reason is looking at a commercial business model, we need a propulsion system that can be reused for years, even extending past a decade. With nuclear thermal systems, can get good performance from them in terms of specific impulse. The thing that we're really struggling with right now is to combine high specific impulse with a long lifetime. If you look at the specifications for NASA's nuclear thermal propulsion system, they need 20 hours of burn time to do their human astronaut mission to Mars. We would want like 2,000 hours to make the investment in that propulsion system worthwhile. Otherwise, we're investing tens or hundreds of millions of dollars to build a space nuclear propulsion system that can only serve a couple of missions. So part of the reason to look at NEP is that you get high performance, but it does have a longer lifetime just because it has different stresses on the system. And the other reason is with NEP, you can get even higher specific impulse. And for us, it's not so much getting a payload to a destination rapidly within a few hours. Our customers are moving spacecraft and satellites, so they can take of the order of days or weeks. So nuclear electric propulsion is fine in terms of transit times. And the higher ISPs also allow us to consume less propellant. And ultimately, one of our main operating costs is going to be propellant. So we're also looking for technologies that can limit propellant consumption and our operating costs.
You made the very understandable decision, let's prove we're competent before we start doing the hardest thing out there. What do you think is a possible timeline for when you would return to really pushing on the nuclear side? Or maybe you are and you've got all sorts of, but when do you think we might see more public action on your side in that
area? We've always invested in nuclear internally. We do have folks who all they do in the company is focus on nuclear. It hasn't been kind of the big public push because for right now, that's really mission one and demonstrating rendezvous on orbit. We are planning a Pathfinder mission. It would be a very small nuclear mission that we would launch. The goal is, let's say, mid to late mid 2020s. Mm-hmm. Is that where we're tracking right now?
Yeah. You know, the unknown for the Pathfinder mission is how long it will take to obtain the necessary approvals for launch. So our goal is to put a very simple, safe reactor through that process and shake out not just the review durations, but then also the criteria for review and safety analyses, because that could inform the design of a larger, more capable system. And right now, we're assuming that from where we are right now, it's going to take at least 3 years, two of which is going to be an intense regulatory approval. So we're spending the next 12 months getting everything ready for those filings and then anticipating 2 years of approval and build of the system. Now, that's one thing that's a critical path to really having us field a larger scale nuclear system. The other is a little more out of our hands. Very serendipitous timing that NASA, the Department of Defense, and the Department of Energy are investing in the qualification of high temperature fuels that are also suitable for our application. So those programs are developing manufacturing fuels that we could use. And once those qualification campaigns are completed, like that is a technology we'd like to incorporate into our systems. So there is a government effort that does dovetail into us realizing nuclear propulsion as well. It's probably going to follow a similar timeline to our in-space demonstration of rendezvous and docking, and then the regulatory Pathfinder mission that William described.
Yeah, I mean, historically, most government nuclear work on the reactor side using uranium has been very highly enriched. So weapons grade material, which is, if not impossible, not practical for a commercial entity to really use. Then you have the very low spectrum, like really low enrichments. Where industry is really moving and what the government has also been pushing for their application is that dividing line, what they call high assay low enriched uranium. So like 19%. So just under the 20% mark. So you're right there. You know, this is not something we want to invest a lot of money into developing. So this goes into like the fuel qualification. The US, particularly Department of Energy, has invested a lot of money in building domestic manufacturing capabilities, because unfortunately that flavor of uranium is not something we have historically made in the country. Mm-hmm. But with the big push, they are starting to build that up with a few companies here.
Great. So your hypothesis is the ecosystem broadly and the supply chains will, you know, hopefully be more ready mid to late decade.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So let's moving away from the nuclear questions for a bit. How did you get started on Atomos? What was the nucleus for this? Or sorry, that was a bad joke. Not even intentional. How did this all get started?
So a lot of it came from my personal background. So I started my career in propulsion, so both for a rocket manufacturer and then in space propulsion, looking at interplanetary missions. So looking at trying to answer the question, how do we get to Mars as quickly as possible with a crew of four astronauts? How can we do these really challenging missions that are just beyond our grasp, like getting to the outer solar system in 12 months? Maybe even doing that mission and having enough Delta V on board our vehicle to do a sample return mission. And then also looking at, okay, what if we want to go interstellar? Like what are near-term technologies that we should be investing in that can realize these missions? And part of that work, I was looking at nuclear electric propulsion. Part of a consortium with other countries involved at the time I was working in Germany, France, Italy, the UK, and Russia were working together on this program. And I was a systems architect and found that if you make some very smart changes to a electric propulsion system design and couple it to a custom reactor, you can do things like get astronauts from low Earth orbit to Mars in 45 days. rather than the design reference missions that are 6 to 9 months. And then if you invest in some technologies that we can realize over the next decade, you can start to do opposition class missions to Mars in less than 3 months. Like, this is stuff that is not possible with chemical propulsion. It is not possible with nuclear thermal propulsion, given materials limits as we know them today. So, you know, this was a very compelling technology that I was frustrated that no one was really investing in with target requirements, with a target mission, or with the budget that really would be feasible to realize this in the near term. Everyone was dabbling in, like, okay, let's do a design of a system and publish some papers. And then that's as far as any program went. So I continued researching that part-time while I went back into launch vehicle design. And this time, rather than designing a specific rocket, I was trying to answer the question of what should Europe build next? Mm-hmm. So looking at what the Ariane 6 rocket should be. And it became very apparent that, you know, we need more flexibility in launch. We need lower costs and more reusability. So this was before SpaceX had started to reuse their Falcon 9 first stage boosters. And then moved to the US and I was working on in-space propulsion systems for spacecraft and realized that, okay, I've experienced the launch vehicle side where we're designing our launch vehicles based on what we think the satellite manufacturers are going to build. On the satellite manufacturer side, you're designing your spacecraft and propulsion systems based on what launch vehicles you think are coming. And because they're coupled and we're guessing what the other party's going to do, they're really suboptimal. So I started looking at, okay, clean slate approach. What is the best way to do space logistics from a commercial perspective? Realized that orbital transfer vehicles that could be reused that are space resident are really a great approach for this to increase flexibility, reduce costs, and achieve more missions. And one of the best technologies for them was my favorite pet technology of nuclear electric propulsion. Mm-hmm. So I started to assess to see if there is a business plan and a near-term need that could support the commercial development of systems like this. And that's where I brought in William. We were first introduced in 2017.
Yeah, so I do not have an engineering background. My background is finance immediately before this. And Colorado is a very big aerospace state. Mm-hmm. And we were introduced through a client of mine who was in the aerospace industry. Vanessa at the time was looking for a business partner to start the company with. When I was younger, I used to run a website in physics, looking at theoretical physics, but just went in a different direction professionally. So we were introduced, started working on it part-time at end of 2017. We took it full-time mid-2018. And then by the fall of 2018, we ended up getting married. So through that whole process, kind of meeting each other, starting the company together, and then very quickly we ended up getting married. And yeah, it's been a lot happening in that first year of the company.
That is a beautiful story. And William, I was quite interested in your journey, just because looking at your LinkedIn, you go from funeral director to finance and then to this. So I mean, it's inspirational to see that people who don't necessarily have PhDs in, you know, aeronautical engineering or you know, rocket science can participate in this sector. I'd be interested to hear about what does it take to launch, to go from idea to implementation with a space startup, which has fairly high capital requirements and long lead times compared to doing something in software. So, you know, Vanessa, you have this idea based on your experiences. How do you actually take that to make it into something that could have a reality?
Yeah. So, I mean, the process that we went through was first validating the market need and rough pricing to see if there was something there, if there was a sustainable business that we could operate and a compelling reason for investors to invest in us. Mm-hmm. Then we laid out milestones to get our first products and services to market and then our eventual goal and broke it up into really large milestones. And so really value inflection points for the company and then solicited investment saying like, hey, if we hit this milestone, here is where we can go from there to help fund us to get to this milestone. Like, this is what we're raising. So structured in a very methodical way. Like, this is how we could capitalize the company and make it appealing to investors and fit the venture funding model. On the flip side of that is technology development. And before you can really develop any technology like this, you have to build a really great team. So right now we're a team of 28 based in Denver, Colorado, which is a great place to be if you're hiring a lot of aerospace engineers. And early technical hires for a project like this are really critical. Not just the right background, but also the right attitude, where it's like, okay, we're in a cost-constrained environment. We have to understand the business needs in terms of realizing an ambitious mission that can move the needle forward for technology development, but also do that in a way that is feasible with the funding we have on hand and with the, say, success criteria we have. We're not NASA. We don't need our first mission to have 99.9% success rate, but, you know, it needs to be enough that we can continue moving the business forward.
Yeah, I think, you know, something that, say, you look at SpaceX that has done extremely well, and it's not always appreciated in aerospace or other very technical fields on how much innovation can happen just in cost and looking at new ways to do something. Maybe, you know, instead of using these heritage space qualified components, you could probably get away with some terrestrial variants, because you know, aerospace is much, I use this analogy all the time, but aerospace is like event spaces. You know, if you want to have an event space for like Uncle Joe's birthday party, here's the price. But if you say this is for a wedding, here's the wedding price. You know, here's the normal price. Oh, you're a space company. Let me give you the space price. And there's a lot of that. So being very conscious on how we're spending money, you know, I think within the company, having the right amount of friction and cost is good, where you can find innovative ways to solve the problem. We really prescribe to the idea that frugality breeds innovation, and we've come up with some pretty neat ideas just because I don't have $3 million to buy the camera that people just buy for space. We don't have that kind of money. So what are some of the alternatives? And in hiring, it's been critical for us, and we focus a lot on the cultural aspect on, is this the type of environment somebody will thrive in? Because there are certainly a lot of folks that just come from the mindset of the schedule gets pushed to the right and the cost goes up. That's just how space programs work. Yeah. But that's not how we work. You know, we have a day we're going to launch and we have a cost target and what things need to get cut to meet those two objectives.
Yeah. And so you talked a little bit about raising capital. And I'd love to hear your thoughts on doing that in the context of a space startup. Because, I mean, again, long timelines, you know, for profitability. Why should any VC invest in space and not just stick with, you know, business SaaS, where you can, you know, have a $1 billion exit in 2 years? Or, you know, I hear generative AI for making marketing newsletters is the best way to make a buck. So is it about sort of an emotional appeal? Is it just, you know, you find the folks who invest in the space? How do you identify the right people to pitch to? And why do you think they invest?
I have an answer for this,
but do you want to go first?
Yeah. So, I mean, there is the correct profile to look out for. There are funds that are focused on hardware or deep tech or aerospace, and also dual use tech, so technologies that don't just serve commercial purposes, but also can help support the US Department of Defense and their mission. So finding those investors is critical. And I mean, the reason they invest in those sectors is because they are somewhat contrarian. Like, we think that there can be great returns in these sectors. And they also see like the state of the existing industrial base here in the US. And they're like, wow, SpaceX really changed things. We wish we were early SpaceX investors. Let's go find the next SpaceX. So there are a cohort of venture funds that do invest in companies like ours. Outside of venture funds, we do have some angel investors and high net worth individuals who've invested. And that's because they just want to be part of something bigger. So finding those individuals is also a lot of fun, because they're definitely like great cheerleaders and great folks to have on your side as well.
Yeah. And I think, well, I would say we expect the same type of exits and returns, you know, as regular companies, maybe not as fast, definitely not 1 to 2 billion, a billion in 1 to 2 years, but still big outsized returns. But, you know, when we started the company, we actually got a fair amount of pushback early on from investors on, well, why is William a co-founder of the company? He's not an engineer. You know, they should be both aerospace engineers. And the reason why, and we 100% agree with this logic now, particularly looking back, is what I said before on how much innovation can happen just in cost and business model and how you do this and how you manage it. Because why I think investing in hardware is not as common as in software is when we're building stuff, we could burn $1 million like that. Yeah. You know, you just buy the wrong components and you've spent a lot of money. It can be pretty hard to correct course if you're not very diligent on when money's going out the door and what decisions you're making.
Yeah. And I think the last point I'd make on this is we're not like a lot of the, I guess, fusion energy startups where they're like, this may work, this may not work. We may do it in 5 years. It may take us 40 years. Like, we have a very clear timeline to get products to market and get revenue and present the opportunity to exit that fits within the typical venture fund's timeline. So being really cognizant of venture investors' needs in terms of what size of return and when that return needs to happen, and making sure that your business model is compatible with that. And if it's not, really striving to make it compatible with that, if that's going to be your main source of capital. And that's one thing that we've done really well. We're launching our first mission next year, so January of 2024. So, you know, it's a pretty short time horizon before we have systems up and operating in space and before we start generating real revenue from services.
Yeah. You know, if there are any aspiring entrepreneurs on listening, like, really understanding, are you putting dollars to solve engineering problems or fundamental science problems? Because that is that. Is a huge distinction in the mind of an investor. And I think in the mind of an engineer, sometimes that line is a little blurred and what's really the difference. But there is a very large difference to somebody who's investing in the company on what is the actual risk they're taking on. Because it's easier to solve engineering problems with patience than just thinking through it. Sometimes fundamental science problems just hit a dead end, and that's it.
And so, I mean, getting back to earlier where you originally had a hugely ambitious idea, you put some of that into a longer timeline. Do you think some of what you're going to need to do for that more ambitious stuff is going to be fundamental science problems, or is it still just in the realm of hard engineering?
It's just in the realm of hard engineering. It's more things like thermal management, like, oh, wow, we really have, you know, high temperatures here and just a few millimeters away, we need to have like this, you know, temperature set point. Like, how are we going to actively control the temperatures? Things like radiation shielding, like, okay, yes, we need to protect this part of the spacecraft using as little material as possible because we don't want to make it too heavy. So these are things that we know are, you know, have been done in the past. It's just engineering optimization. I'd say that the big remaining challenges from a technical perspective that are going to be the most difficult for us to burn down are related to lifetime. So just like I spoke about with the nuclear thermal propulsion system, nuclear electric has lifetime issues as well. And then add, you know, high temperature and high radiation environment. So it's not something that is going to make our systems not work. It could potentially limit the return or the revenue generated over the lifetime of the first couple of generations of vehicles. So our big residual risks are things that aren't going to be catastrophic or make our business infeasible. They're the things that we'd want to improve in subsequent generations.
Yeah, you know, I'd say most materials don't like either, well, they don't like either or all of them, a lot of heat, a lot of electricity, or a lot of radiation. A nuclear-powered spacecraft, unfortunately, has all three. But, yeah. But, you know, to Vanessa's point, there are engineering ways you can solve certain problems. So think of a lot of electricity. You know, a big problem with electric thrusters is cathode degradation. So there's a lot of current is flowing through it. It degrades over time, really affecting your performance. So you could invest a lot of money in creating new materials to avoid that. You could invest money in creating new geometries, or you could just put two thrusters. And like when one burns out, then you take over with the other one. And now the problem you're solving is more of a control dynamics problem on, all right, if the second thruster is slightly off center, how does that affect your pointing accuracy? And can you build that into your control algorithms? You've really reduced it to an engineering problem. And thinking through things like that is, you know, in our view, how you kind of build the company over time and just iterate through. It's really reducing it down to what is the most solvable aspect of the problem. Can we start there and then move forward instead of, well, creating a new material, creating unobtainium sounds like an awesome problem. Let's start there because that sounds really cool.
No, I really love how you're framing this as sort of solving business problems versus engineering problems versus scientific problems. And your role as entrepreneurs is different perhaps than what, you know, a government contractor might be asked to do. And I think that is very helpful advice for aspirational space entrepreneurs. And people sometimes forget that for a long time, I think SpaceX really was innovating much more on cost and business model. It didn't get to sort of the really challenging scientific and or engineering things like reusability until they've proven they can at least get to space. That's sort of overlooked. So turning a little bit towards bigger picture ecosystem questions, what do you think would help accelerate the deep space ecosystem? Right now, it seems like LEO is self-sustaining economically, where governments are an important participant, but you have the private sector really doing its own thing independently to some degree. You know, it feels like we're pretty far away from that in both cislunar and beyond cislunar, more deep space. You know, do you think we'll ever get to that point where maybe there's a self-sustaining economy in deep space? And what would be needed for that to happen? Or what do you think we just need to make progress in doing more in deep space that's useful?
So I'm thinking about, I guess, the ecosystem evolution. You know, we're going through a series of epochs. We've hit really the commercial era with, you know, low cost launch to low Earth orbit, lower cost spacecraft, so that a lot of business cases close for things like communication, position, navigation, timing, Earth observation. Now we're seeing that kind of the possibilities in low Earth orbit are opening up to other orbits. And this is kind of our entry point to the market as well. Mm-hmm. You know, our mission statement as a company is to make any orbit as accessible as low Earth orbit. And there are business opportunities in higher orbits. And so I see that as really the next epoch that we're going to enter. So position, navigation, and timing, telecommunications in particular, from higher orbits are really compelling business models that right now are done by state actors or by large corporations. There's very limited room for innovation. And that's one thing that we want to bring with our services and lower costs and more accessibility to those orbits. The next epoch that I am predicting is really a cislunar economy. And so this is something that's going to initially be anchored by NASA and European Space Agency. So ESA has their Moon Village program, NASA has Artemis and their commercial lunar payload services program. Programs like that will start to develop the technologies and capabilities to do missions in and around the moon and cislunar space. And an ecosystem will spring up to support them, just like we have seen with one great ecosystem is with the SpaceX ride-sharing missions transporter. There is a whole ecosystem of providers that help get payloads onto those rockets. Very similar for, I guess, this scenario. If you are operating on the surface of the moon, you need position, navigation, and timing, and communications, and maybe observation and mapping from lunar orbit. It's a whole bunch of different businesses that need to happen to support the state's mission in this case. And so for that to really be self-sustaining, I think is going to take decades. And I think that where NASA's going with the Artemis program and the architecture that they've selected, they will be doing those classes and missions for a long time. For the commercial economy to build up to a point where it is sustainable, right? This is, lunar resource utilization is obviously going to be a big one, and then eventually off-world manufacturing. But I think that there really needs to be an anchor government customer and mission to allow that ecosystem to build up. Moving beyond the moon, I don't know. Obviously, there are more issues because there isn't a centralized location. I really think that Mars is probably going to be the next destination that has kind of a similar mission push from the government and then a commercial ecosystem and capability that builds up around it. But, you know, I really hope that the two upcoming epochs that I outlined, like higher Earth orbit commercial missions that are Earth-centric, followed by cislunar, I hope that really comes to fruition in reality, because a lot of the technologies and models that would be realized during those periods are things that would also support deeper space exploration.
Yeah, I mean, I think the biggest limiting factor has just been logistics, which is what we are looking to solve. You know, it's just every moving around beyond LEO right now is very bespoke and requires a lot of investment for unique architectures, unique launch vehicles, unique missions. But if you had a robust on-orbit logistics network that we would be providing, it certainly makes moving beyond the geo belt a lot easier. Additionally, there is quite a bit of money on the government side, both domestically and internationally, in cislunar space. And they are putting quite a bit in there to develop that ecosystem, because most nations see it as, you know, a strategically important area, looking just beyond geo. And some of the questions that are trying to be answered is, well, now as we expand out and capabilities on orbit expand out, how do you take analogous terrestrial things and apply them to space? So as an example, if you have a lot of commercial investment in a cislunar architecture, well, how does the U.S. government protect its commercial interests up there? You know, if something happens, do we have anything that could respond and say, like, just intervene? And no, you can't do that. It's like they do on Earth, where, you know, early days of all nations, you have the U.S. Navy kind of protecting shipping lanes and stuff like that. Is an architecture like that going to be built in space, where as much as we would love to believe it's true, it unfortunately, all the countries don't get along, and they're probably never all going to get along, at least for the foreseeable future. So everyone's going to have their own kind of priorities and initiatives. And how do we just say, all right, this is my area, this is your area, and can we all just at least live in some form of harmony?
Right. And you know, Vanessa, I noticed earlier on you talked about the United States and Europeans as the primary actors in the cislunar economy. Of course, the Chinese are looking very seriously at this and seem to have the capacity to make a serious move there. So it'll be interesting to see how that competition plays out. Just going one step beyond before we bring this back home, but do you believe that becoming a multi-planetary species is a worthwhile goal? And why or why not? This is for both of you.
I mean, I would say yes, definitely yes. And this is more of my personality, and I would say even role in the company. I am a contingency planner. What happens if? And right now there's, you know, what happens if something happens to Earth, if an asteroid lands on Earth or something like that, very catastrophic, where there's nothing we could do about it. You know, really spreading beyond just a single planet and ensuring the continuity of humanity is a very important thing and something worthwhile to invest in.
Yeah, I agree with William. Besides becoming a multi-planetary species, also creating robust planetary defense systems to protect from near-Earth objects. Like, that really makes sense as well. And a lot of the technologies we're developing obviously contribute to both of those missions. You know, the one thing that I'd like to add to the discourse is, like, I think we're humans, we want to explore, we want to learn more. If you look at the models that we have of the universe and our understanding of physics, we want to continue pushing the boundary and our knowledge and learning more so that we can maybe shape the future of the universe for better. And part of that gaining knowledge is exploring off-world. And so I think that we shouldn't do that just for our own preservation, but also for the pursuit of exploration and scientific knowledge beyond our own species.
I love that. I think those are so complementary. One, a little bit of fear, and then on the other side, a little bit of joy. So
yeah,
most great endeavors have both.
It's why Vanessa and I worked well together, because we do have that balance. Yeah, as Vanessa says, productive paranoia and more of like the optimism.
Mm-hmm.
The question in my mind that I won't ask right now because it'd be too intrusive is, I wonder if that will play out in your roles as parents. My wife and I definitely have some of that dynamic of paranoia versus exploring.
We have a 2.5-year-old daughter, and it does kind of play out, I think, like that. Yeah, I would say that's very similar in parenting style.
That's great. Some couples start off by getting dogs to see what they'd be like as parents. You two started off by creating a company. And then I guess that worked out well enough to take the next step.
Yeah.
Just a couple final questions to close things out. William, I'm going to start with you. You were part of the government-sponsored study on space nuclear regulation that led to SPD-6. What did you learn from that process, and what do you think still needs to be done on the regulatory side?
Learned, aside from just kind of helping develop the process and us providing a lot of inputs, you know, that how much space nuclear is important to the US, and really their willingness to listen to commercial entities and kind of figure out a way that is beneficial for everyone, and not just say, here's, yay, verily, this is what you have to do and comply to. They wanted a lot of input. There are still some gaps in the policy. So it's really, you know, was policy documents and not setting specific regulation. And one of the other missing features is it focuses on getting to orbits. Mm-hmm. Now, operating in orbits is less well-defined. As a company like ours, this is very critical. There are, you know, guidelines that have been established on, you know, maintaining nuclear safe orbits, but there is no definition of what that is. And this is part of our Pathfinder mission, is helping, you know, push that forward with an actual mission on where are some of these boundaries.
That makes a lot of sense. Now, Vanessa, according to your bio, you read a book a week. How do you manage to do that while being a CEO and mother? I'm not the CEO of anything, and I don't manage to accomplish that.
So let's say about 25% of my reading is like an actual book, and that's really an indulgence. I am a prolific audiobook listener, like at double speed. Anytime like I am doing household chores or trying to put the toddler down for bedtime, like it's always have, you know, a narrator in my ear. And then if there is a good book that I want to go through and absorb more slowly, I will buy the physical version of it. But like, it's, you know, just hungry for more material and more knowledge all the time. And it's really the only way I can absorb that much that quickly.
No, that's great. So not being overly attached to a format, but always striving to learn and absorb more.
Yeah.
That's a beautiful place to end. So thank you to Vanessa and William for joining us on the show.
Yeah, thank you for having
us. Thanks, Tim.
Thank you to Vanessa and William for joining the Multiplanetary Society podcast. And thank you to all our listeners. If you like this content, please make sure to subscribe on your favorite podcasting platform to ensure you don't miss an episode, and leave a review to help other people find it. If you have any feedback or guest suggestions, please feel free to email us at multiplanetarysociety all one word with no dashes, at gmail.com.